before summarizing that first part of chapter 14 that I covered last time and then finishing out the chapter, I want to give you a handout about something, but first I need you to back up with me to chapter 13. Turn to Revelation chapter 13, and let's revisit for just a moment the subject of the number of the beast. I started to mention this when we were in this chapter a few weeks ago, but since it's something of a peripheral matter, I didn't bring it up. It's well known to people who do an even moderately intensive study in this part of the book of Revelation, but I did not realize until I was doing some recent web surfing that this particular topic has been in the news lately, and lest you see it without my having commented upon it, I wanted to go ahead and draw this to your attention. Now, you see there, the last verse of chapter 13, verse 18, it talks about it's the number of a man, and his number is what? Thank you. Nobody said 666. It's 666. Now, I have the Reformation Study Bible, and they don't indicate... I started to say they don't indicate the variant reading, but if you have some sort of reference Bible or study Bible, you may notice a little superscript letter or number next to the 666, which is calling your attention to a footnote at the bottom. Does anybody have that in their Bible? What does it say, Joel?
By the time of Domitian, the early emperor Nero had become a traditional Antichrist figure in 666, probably already known to be in numerical values.
Okay, let me just interrupt you. I'm not talking about that little commentary. I mean some sort of note about the text itself, about that word. You have the Reformation Study Bible? Okay, if you look above where those study notes are, underneath the text itself, you should see a reference that says some manuscripts read 616. Now, what that refers to is this. When Greek New Testament scholars begin looking at ancient manuscripts of these texts, they have a variety of texts that they look at. And part of the challenge is that you may have a whole group of these texts and we'll have fragments of chapter this or maybe a whole book of this particular book of the New Testament. In the case of the book of Revelation, there have not been very many really ancient texts. Most of the copies in the Greek of the book of Revelation are fairly recent, like from the 10th, 9th century, that time period. There have been, though, some that have been known for quite a while that on that particular text, and these are very ancient copies, they don't read 666, 666, they read 616, 616. Now, let me read to you from, this is a standard textual commentary on the Greek New Testament. Just about anybody who studies Greek New Testament in any seminary, Protestant or Roman Catholic, and perhaps even Greek Orthodox, is usually going to wind up using this book. It's by one of the great New Testament scholars, Dr. Bruce Metzger, who teaches at Princeton, I believe. And this whole thing is just about all these variant readings throughout the New Testament where there's some question about, is it really this or is it really that? Because you got these manuscripts that read it this way, and then you got these that read it that way. Here's what he says about this particular difference in those two numbers. He says, when Greek letters are used as numerals, and by the way, we didn't, I'm assuming you know this, so what does 666, what did we say that really stood for? Nero Kaiser. And the way we got there is that John is thinking of the name in Hebrew, but he's using the Greek numbered equivalent of the name. So when you take the name in Hebrew, Nero Kaiser, and you factor in the numerical value of each of the letters, it equals exactly 666. Now that's kind of a Neron as opposed to Nero, Khazar. It's kind of a little bit variant way of pronouncing it, but when you go from one language to the next, sometimes that's what happens. He says, when Greek letters are used as numerals, the difference between 666 and 616 is merely a change from one letter to the other. Perhaps the change was intentional. Now listen, seeing that the Greek form Neron Kaiser, written in Hebrew letters, is equivalent to 666, whereas the Latin form Nero Kaiser, written in Hebrew, is equivalent to 616. Now, let me hand out to you a little sheet of paper here on the front and the back. This was in the news just about a week ago. There should be one for everybody. About a more recent fragment of this passage from the book of Revelation that has been discovered, and with the increasing progress in computer technology and the surveying and studying of ancient manuscripts like this, we now have a number of fairly well-respected scholars who are saying that that reading probably originally was 616 and not 666. And let me see here if they make the point. Now, he says on the back page something about the 616 refers to Emperor Caligula. I don't know where he's getting that idea from. But if you see also about midway on the back page, some have also linked 666 with Nero. Parker points out the possibility of 616 was considered by the Second Century Church Father Irenaeus. He rejected it. Regarding this text, Parker told Britain's Church Times, "This adds weight to those who believe that it is a reference to Caligula's attempt to desecrate the temple in Jerusalem. There may be a reference to it in Mark 13:14. People believe that you could get from 666 to Nero because in the Greek he is the emperor Neron Khazar, and 666 is one number less than perfect, 777. The text showing 616 is quite legible to the naked eye." Somewhere, I don't know if it was in here, but they pointed out that if you drop the N from the Hebrew pronunciation, it becomes 616. At any rate, the point that I'm trying to make to you with this is that the more we come by these discoveries, the more it supports the argument that what we're dealing with here is a first century reference. In other words, whether it's 666 or 616, Nero is the guy that fits the bill. It just so happens that when you take the Latin form of Nero's name and spell it in Hebrew, as opposed to just putting it in Greek and then putting it into Hebrew, you get 616. And lo and behold, there's a variant reading that's one of among the oldest of the manuscript copies we have, and that's what it reads. Okay, let me move on from there now and just quickly summarize what we talked about in the first part of chapter 14. We find there a reference again to the 144,000, and we said that that was the same group of people that was referenced in chapter 7. And that this represented a symbolic number of the faithful remnant of all of believing Israel. And we also pointed out the importance of understanding the use of certain terms like oikoumene, where it talks about the whole world. And we talked about the fact that oikoumene is a word frequently used in the New Testament and translated world, but it is more localized to the known world, the populated world, as opposed to a universal idea of the entire planet. Those people didn't think that way. They didn't know about Japan and South America, or even Boston Spa, New York, if you can believe it. They didn't know about that. And so when they thought of, they used a term like oikoumene, it meant the Roman Empire. And so we find these words that localize these texts and make it more pertinent to the first century setting. And we also see a reference again to this business about the mark on the hand and on the forehead. And far from having anything to do with modern computer chips or barcodes or any of this other stuff that the dispensationalists talk about, we find a clear reference to this sort of thing in Deuteronomy chapter 6 and chapter 10, I believe it was, where God tells the Israelites that my law and my teaching should be as frontlets between your eyes, and you should put it on the back of your right hand. The right hand is a symbol of power and authority and ability. And having something here means that it's always on your mind. It's before you constantly. Didn't mean to literally have a mark on your hand or literally put something on your head. It's just a symbolic way of talking about these things. And we find that same language being used here in this first part of chapter 14. Then I also made a point to show you another connection that shows that what's taking place here is that with the closing down of the Old Covenant era, the New Covenant is dawning. Old Israel, which was defined primarily as an ethnic geographical entity, is now being superseded and transformed into a multinational, multi-ethnic entity that are bound together through covenant in the Messiah. Before, because of the way the laws were set up and just because of the way things worked in God's economy, you had to be of the blood of Israel, or circumcised and covenantally received into the people of Israel. And, you know, you can make of it what you will, but the fact is there were just a lot of people, men especially, who weren't happy about becoming Jews in order to be in the covenant. And if you can need to figure that out, you can talk to me later. But most of these people didn't want to be circumcised. I'll just be honest about it. And so there were all these kind of hindrances and roadblocks to the universality of the covenant. But in the Messiah, all that was done away with. And we see this language about there being a first fruits to God and to the Lamb. That is something else that draws us back to the Old Testament. The first fruit offering was that which was the quality offering given to God. And what we find being talked about here is the first fruits being those first Jewish converts to the Lord. And that is another indication that Israel, which was considered the first fruit of God himself in the Old Covenant, now the church becomes the first fruits of God, these early believers. So we see another transformation taking place there. And I made the point to say to you, as we look at chapter 14, 6 and 7, for I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to those who dwell on the land, as opposed to the whole earth. It means the land of Israel. And then to every nation, tribe, and tongue, and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea, and the springs of water. There is an immediacy here. This is something referring to these people who received this information needed to know about. You don't need to know about something that's going to happen 2,000 years from now. You may think you do, I don't know. But I'm not that concerned about something that's going to happen 10 years from now. Not to say you shouldn't plan for the future, but let's face it, friends. If somebody comes up to you and says, I've got some information you must know about. 10,000 years from now, this is going to happen. Well, I don't think you're going to go out and dig a bomb shelter in your backyard when you hear that. Maybe some people would, but most of us wouldn't. And I called your attention to these rather disturbing passages in the Gospel of Matthew, where Jesus says to the disciples, you will not have gone through all the towns of Israel until you see the Son of Man coming, until I return. And he said in Matthew 10:23, I will return before you have reached all the towns of Israel. And as I said, there's only two ways to slice that. Either it happened or it didn't. And if it didn't happen, well, that means that he was wrong. If it did happen, it means that we've got to somehow understand what it means and what he meant by that. And my argument to you has been that this has reference to the closing down of the Old Covenant and Christ returning, quote-unquote, in judgment. All right, I want to pick up from there. That's sort of a whirlwind tour of most of what we talked about last week. Let's move on. But something I wanted to point out to you, I made a reference to this early on when we began this part of the study, going back to chapter 12. We have seen so far, and I want to flesh this out just a little bit more. We have seen so far this cycle of seven business. We've got the seven seals and the seven trumpets, the seven lampstands. There are all these sevens that keep recurring. Now, when we got to chapter 12, it looked like things were kind of going in a different direction because we didn't have the obvious sevens being stated. But what I've listed on the board here is that from chapters 12 through 14, you still have that seven cycle going. And these are the seven things that you find listed through those chapters, because chapter 12 through 14 are really one vision cycle, and it encompasses those seven elements, these symbolic images. You've got the woman clothed with the sun, the great red dragon, the man-child, the beast from the sea, the beast from the land, the lamb on Mount Zion, and the Son of Man on the cloud, which we'll be talking about in just a moment. The key element to be mindful of in this is not so much that the number seven recurs through these visions, but rather that the visions themselves, when interpreted in their proper context, all are presenting the same message of prophetic forecast of the covenant doom of national Israel in that time and place. All right, look with me at verse 14. Revelation 14, verse 14. Then I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and on the cloud sat one like the Son of Man, having in his hand a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. Now, clouds symbolize various things in apocalyptic and prophetic writings. And here, they are meant to convey the ideas of, first of all, the transcendent majesty of the Lord and his sovereign work in history, in the history of humanity, and particularly at that stage in redemption history, with the closing down of one age and the dawning of another. What I'm telling you is that this is, as I've written up here, spiritual things being described in spiritual language. And does anybody really believe that Jesus needs to ride a cloud or stand on a cloud? I guess maybe some people do. You get some of these dispensational books on prophecy and they got the drawings in there and they really think that's what they're going to see. Clouds also speak of the coming judgment of God. As in, for example, if you'll turn to Isaiah chapter 19, verse 1. Isaiah chapter 19, verse 1. This is a very good example of how cloud language is used in the older covenant, where we are seeing time and again much of the imagery and much of the symbolism, much of the language is coming from in the book of Revelation. Isaiah 19, verse 1. If somebody has that, could I see a volunteer? Somebody like to read that, please? Sam? All right, now what is that verse telling us? Somebody give me a two-sentence summary of what that verse is telling us.
There's going to be a judgment against Egypt.
It means it's bad news for Egypt. I mean, that's the gist of it. No ancient Hebrew read this and believed that God was going to go swooping in on a cloud. But they did believe God's covenant wrath would come upon Egypt. The prophet sees that wrath and covenant judgment of God coming upon Egypt as he metaphorically uses the cloud imagery to depict the scene and make the point. And Randall Otto, who wrote a book, a doctoral dissertation on this whole subject of the cloud imagery as it speaks of eschatology and end-time scenarios, he says, and I quote, "The nature of the cloud, together with the climate of Palestine, make it a particularly suitable symbol for the swiftness and power of God both to protect and destroy." So you see, the people are drawing on the things ready to hand to get the point across to people who would have understood the meaning and the significance of what that's all about. The author of the Apocalypse had previously used cloud language in speaking of the impending judgment of Christ upon the enemies of the Lord. In chapter 1, he said, "Lo, he doth, and I'm going to read this from Young's literal translation. This is about the most literal word-for-word translation of the English Bible you can get a hold of. "Lo, he doth come with the clouds, and see him shall every eye, even those who did pierce him, and wail because of him, shall all the tribes of the land." That's Revelation 1:7. So right away, in the very first chapter, we've got the cloud imagery being used to talk about the coming judgment of the Son of Man against his enemies. And it's even more specific. Let's revisit that and re-stress that point. Who is it that he's coming to judge? What does it say? Those who pierced him. And all the tribes of the land. Well, who can that possibly be? It's got to be. It's got to be the people of Israel. They're the ones who are the tribes of the land, and they're the ones ultimately responsible for his piercing or his execution. And it's of some importance for the modern reader to understand that those New Testament texts that speak of the Son of Man are using language not in a literal sense of seeing, as you see I put up here, because the text says that these people will see him. Every eye shall see him. It's not using it in the sense of, well, I see you all sitting there, but more in the sense of, oh, I see now what you mean. I understand, you see. See, I just used it, you see. It's built into our language. We're not talking about the physical organs of sight. We're speaking of seeing as in coming to understand something, that the kingly authority of Christ would be manifested providentially in the world historical events associated with the destruction of the city of Jerusalem and the temple. So we have that imagery then, and verse 14 of chapter 14 presents an interesting reversal of fortune in that Christ went to his death wearing a crown of thorns, whereas here, in his glorious ascended power, he's depicted wearing a crown of gold. And in his hand, he carries a sharp sickle. Now, Mark's gospel has some similar imagery, and it's used there to speak of a final harvest. Turn with me to Mark chapter 4, verses 26 to 29. Mark 4, 26 to 29. Mark 4, 26 to 29. And if I could have a volunteer to read that, please, if you want to read it, raise your hand. Now here, thank you, Joel, here is yet another well-read gospel passage. I dare say there's not a person in here who at least heard this once before. That is all too typically read out of context and with no real sense of the eschatological, that is, end of time imminence and urgency that those words would have conveyed to the original audience who heard Jesus say this. The whole point of that parable was that the time for the harvest was soon, about to take place. And when the blade falls, it will be too late for some people. And verse 14 of Revelation 14 makes the point, if you'll turn back there, that the blade of that sickle is what? What does it say? Excuse me? Sharp. The New Testament writers didn't waste their words. If they put the word sharp in there, there's a reason it was there. And that bespeaks of the severity and the power of the judgment. All right, let's look at verses 15 to 16. Revelation 14, verses 15 to 16, if I could have a volunteer to read that, please. Now, let me ask you a question. Where is the reaping taking place, do you think? So many people have been paying attention here.
In Israel.
Why do you say that?
Because you refer back earlier, and he is addressing Israel.
Well, there's that, but there's also this Greek word, which I'm sure you all can read. Even if you could read Greek, you probably couldn't read my rendition of it. It's pronounced geis. And like that word oikoumene, which is translated world into English, but it doesn't mean the full circumference, this word is often translated earth. And when we think of the earth, we think of that big blue globe sitting out there, taken when the picture was taken from the moon, unless you're one of these people that doesn't believe the moon landing really took place. It was all faked out in the desert in Arizona or something. There are people who believe that. They didn't think of the whole earth. It's localized. It means land. The reaping is taking place in the land. What land? The land of Israel. Now, I noted previously to you that the 144,000 mentioned in chapter 7, they were a representative group who symbolized those believing Jews in the land of Israel who proclaimed that Jesus was the true Messiah. And in addition, there are two other points that we noted. First, that these Jewish believers, these Jewish Christians, they were likened unto the first fruits of the harvest. I mentioned that a while ago. But secondly, that with the first fruits having been accomplished, Gentile believers, those of every nation and tribe and tongue, they were now invited to come into the covenant through Jesus. And verses 15 through 20 follow in this Revelation 14 chapter. They follow that overall motif established previously by Paul to the Jew first, but also to the Greek or to the Gentile. Now verses 15 to 16 speak of the harvest of souls from the earth, which is typologically signifying the Jewish believers from the land of Judea in that first century setting. See, that's one other reason that Jesus could tell them, you will not have gone through all the cities of Israel before I return. But obviously, if you're talking about where Jews lived on every part of the globe, that couldn't happen in a generation. But if you're talking about the Oikoumene, the Roman Empire, that was well within reach. Although to their minds, they might not have understood how that could possibly happen. But by the time of the destruction of the temple in AD 70, there was virtually no part of the Roman Empire that had not been touched by the gospel, but more specifically, the Jews of the empire had all heard the news that this man Jesus claimed to be the Messiah, that he rose again. These are the claims you accepted or you rejected. In the next chapter, when we get to 15, a similar harvest of Gentile souls that are going to be typologically portrayed as a harvesting of the sea is going to be presented to the reader. But verse 16 here in chapter 14 is reminiscent of that same passage that I referred to a while ago in Mark's Gospel, chapter 4, where he talks about the ripening of the harvest and putting in the sickle. Now, it's interesting when you start having dialogue and discussion with people about this idea about the past fulfillment of most of these prophecies. A lot of people will point to Acts chapter 1, Acts 1 verses 9 to 11, as an example of a verse whereby there could not possibly be a past fulfillment in the first century interpretation of that passage. Now that's the passage where the disciples are talking to Jesus and he's taken up in a cloud and there are two men standing by who we take to be angels who say to them, "Why are you standing here? This same Jesus whom you see going up will return in like manner that you see him go up," or something along that line. Now, I think it's at least plausible, if not interpretively correct and accurate, to respond to that claim by saying that the very content of Revelation 14:14 and the following verses is a refutation that Acts 1, 9 to 11 could not have possibly taken place or be understood as being past fulfilled. In Acts chapter 1, the apostles are, as I said, are watching as Jesus ascends into heaven on a cloud, and they're told he'll return in like manner. In Revelation 14, he is now shown descending on a cloud to reap the harvest of his faithful remnant church. I think there could possibly be a fulfillment of what they said in Acts 1 as having taken place now, though a generation later. There's been much misunderstanding about these kind of verses, and it's been linked to an improper literalistic hermeneutic or interpretive method being applied into areas where it's not called for. But the very use of it distorts the true meaning of the text, and it goes back to this little phrase that I put here. Spiritual things are used to describe things in spiritual terms. And those are some of the examples of using types of language to describe things in a spiritual or symbolic way. One commentator says the seeing mentioned in these verses is not the seeing of the eye but of the understanding, and was fulfilled in the events culminating in the fall of Jerusalem. Now one of the key interpretive principles that is too often overlooked by those of the total futurist interpretation or orientation is that these passages of the Bible are speaking of and describing spiritual things, but they want to take this literalistic approach to them. And that's what leads to some of these distortions. And that's what leads to the constant revision and the changing of the, oh, well, it's not this, it's that. It's not Gorbachev with that thing on his head. That's the mark of the beast. No, it's Saddam Hussein now, or whatever the case may be. You see, they're constantly revising these things. And as I say there, this speaking of spiritual things and spiritual language, it commonly employs things like poetic license, exaggerated imagery. And for those of you who've heard me talk about this before, give me some examples. You've heard me use some examples. Let me see if you can come up. What's some examples of exaggerated speech that we use in our day-to-day language?
I told you once, I told you a minute.
Yeah, exactly. But one of the key points is that coming from where this comes from, in this part of the ancient Near East, the modern descendants of many of these people still talk this way. And when the first Gulf War took place in 91, what was it Saddam Hussein was saying? What are some of the language he used about how he was going to vanquish American forces? You remember any of that? The streets of Baghdad will run with the blood of, you know, all this kind of stuff. And they still use this kind of language over there. All right, let's look at verses 17 to 20 of Revelation 14. Revelation 14, 17 to 20, if I can have a volunteer, please. Okay, Ruth, thank you. Thank you. Now, we have seen now a series of harvests taking place. Who did I tell you the previous harvest was the focus of? Who was being harvested in the first? The people, who specifically of Israel? The remnant believers, of which that number is symbolic of all those faithful Jews who confess Christ as the true Messiah. But now, what about this harvest that we just read about? Who do you think that might be? Okay. Not exactly. I mean, it may include Gentiles, but there's a more important qualitative distinction. The previous... Yes, Sam? Exactly. Unbelievers. I mean, there's nothing about the previous harvest referring to the wrath of God. These people are going right into the wine press of the wrath of God. These people are covenant breakers. They're not covenant keepers. Now, there's an interesting take on this. If you'll turn to Matthew chapter 3, turn to Matthew chapter 3, beginning at verse 5. John the Baptist had early on, distant early warning. He had early on warned the leaders of Israel about this coming judgment. And you compare this language that we just read in verse 17 of Revelation 14 with what he says here, you can see the correspondence and the correlation. Matthew 3, 5 to 12. Could I have a volunteer to read that, please? Matthew 3, 5 to 12. Any volunteers? Okay, Joy?
Then Jerusalem, all Judea, and all the region around the Jordan went out to him and were baptized by him in the Jordan, confessing their sins. But when he saw many of the Pharisees and Sadducees coming to be baptized, to his baptism, he said to them, "Prove the Bible.
All right, stop right there. See, there's wrath coming. And again, if we're going to be fair to John the Baptist and to the writers, he's not telling them about something that's going to happen 5,000 years later. He's warning them. You better get ready. Go ahead.
Therefore, bear fruits worthy of repentance, and do not think to say to yourselves, "We have Abraham as our father." For I say to you that God is able to raise up children to Abraham from these stones. And even now,
okay, here's a warning. Wrath is coming. The Messiah is about to come. And you people, you're a brood of vipers. You're going to bear the brunt of it. Now turn over to Matthew 21. Jesus tells a very striking parable that even more closely parallels and correlates with what we just read in Revelation 14. This is the parable of the vine dresser. What was the imagery in Revelation 14? Grapes, the vines being reaped and harvested, the wine press. Matthew 21:33, hear another parable. There was a certain landowner who planted a vineyard and set a hedge around it. Verse 34, now when vintage time drew near, harvest time, he sent his servants to the vine dressers that they might receive its fruit. Verse 36, he sent other servants, more than the first, and they did likewise to them. Then the last of all, he sent his son to them, saying, they will respect my son. Verse 38, but when the vine dressers saw the son, they said, this is the heir, come let us kill him. So they took him and cast him out of the vineyard and killed him. Therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those vine dressers? They said to him, he will destroy those wicked men miserably. Jesus said to them, have you never read in the scriptures the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone? Verse 43, therefore I say to you, the kingdom of God will be taken from you and given to a nation bearing the fruits of it. And whoever falls on this stone will be broken, but on whomever it falls it will grind him to powder. Now when the chief priests and Pharisees heard his parables, they perceived that he was speaking of them. The New Living Translation has, when the leading priests and Pharisees heard Jesus, they realized he was pointing at them. They were the farmers in this story. Verse 45. How can you miss the connection between what Jesus has just said about the vine and the destruction and what Revelation is talking about? And same thing in chapter 14. Now, verse 20 of Revelation 14 once more points us to a local first century time and location where it speaks of the winepress being trodden outside the city. What city is it? Well, we know from Revelation 11 verse 8, it's already identified the city in very unmistakable language. It's the place where the Messiah was crucified. And that can only be Jerusalem. It can only be Jerusalem because that's where he was crucified. That gives us the place. That tells us what city it is. Why does it also tell us the time frame? Well, when was he crucified? In the first century. Probably around AD 33. And verse 20 uses this exaggerated metaphor language to speak of the severity of the judgment. The blood will flow so deeply it will reach the horse's bridles. Now, you'll find similar language in Isaiah chapter 63, verses 3 to 4. Let me read that for you. Isaiah wrote, and remember, Isaiah is writing to the people of Israel at a previous time in their history when judgment was upon them. He says, I have trodden the winepress alone, and from the peoples no one was with me. For I have trodden them in my anger and trampled them in my fury. Their blood is sprinkled upon my garments, and I have stained all my robes. For the day of vengeance is in my heart, and the year of my redeemed has come. Now, you know, it's certainly possible that you could have on a full lot of clothing and maybe just barely prick your finger and get a little bit of blood on your clothes. But when you're into some serious bloodshed, that's when your garments get stained. That's when you really get covered with blood. And you see, this is what all this sort of highfalutin blood up to the bridles language is meant to convey, and that's what the measuring length of furlongs and all that is meant to convey. The whole idea here in this exaggerated poetic language is that the judgment is going to be severe and it's going to be extensive. It's not just going to be on this few people over here, but the whole shooting match is going to suffer. The whole city is going down. The closing verses of the chapter are meant to convey that idea to the reader, both the severity of God's coming judgment upon Israel and the extent of it. It will be total from beginning outside the city as it builds into a flood tide of what will be horrific destruction. All right, that concludes our study in chapter 14. Let me just see if you have any questions or comments.